Welcome to episode 33 of All of Your Business. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents raise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. On this episode, we're excited to welcome Ashley Henry, Executive Director for Business for a Better Portland. And now your host, Michael Jonas.
Thank you so much, Ashley, for being here. I really appreciate that you decided to be on our podcast.
Thanks for asking.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's so much to talk about, but one of the things I really wanted to talk about was, how did you get to this point? You know, it seems like you have a background of all sorts of things. How did you end up doing your job?
In this particular role, yeah, it's actually quite comforting because, you know, I started this job when I was in my late 40s. And up until that point, I think that my parents and some of my friends were like, now what are you doing next? And I can actually now take, you know, and connect a dot to every single job that I've had since getting out of college in the early 90s and point to how all of those roles, however different they were, all really fold into the role that I'm playing now. And so it's, I guess, it's heartening to me and makes me feel like I have, you know, been on a journey, even at times that I didn't quite know what I was doing. And I was definitely feeling my way through it at the time. And it certainly wasn't always planful. A lot of times it was more intuitive, and sometimes more emotional. It has led me to a place where I really feel like I'm doing the work that I was meant to do.
Very cool. And what is Business for a Better Portland, so people know?
Sure. Business for a Better Portland is a membership organization. We're a business membership organization that started here in Portland in 2017. And we bring together the voices primarily of small to medium-sized companies that typically don't feel that their voice is heard in the civic arena, whether that's at City Hall, at Metro Council, at the state legislature. And honestly, they don't necessarily even know how to amplify their voice there. And so a group of entrepreneurs back in 2016 came together to start something called the Portland Independent Chamber of Commerce. And I was very thrilled to see what they were doing. And I volunteered with them for a while, and one thing led to another, and we eventually became a full-fledged incorporated organization as Business for a Better Portland. And for the last 4 years now, we've been working on issues of affordable housing and homelessness, transportation, and economic opportunity. And our work involves us creating those opportunities, we call them civic engagement on-ramps, for small business owners and businesses like yours who, in the absence of our support, might not have the time or capacity to express their support or opposition to a particular policy issue. And yet, we know what a small business town Portland is. And so we feel like we've been providing a really important civic function.
Yeah, I think you are. I think you've done a great job. How has COVID affected what you were doing and maybe changed the path a little bit to what you were doing?
Well, in two major ways. So just very practically speaking, that civic engagement on-ramp that I referenced earlier was oftentimes inspired by in-person gatherings. We, starting in 2017, when we became a membership organization, had gatherings that started at, you know, 20, 25 people who wanted to get together and learn about a particular issue around affordable housing or a transportation policy that was before the city council. And those work groups, as we called them back then, really blossomed over the course of a few years to gatherings of 200, 300 people for, you know, major gatherings of not just a social time, but also a learning time with panels, very thoughtful panels that were usually moderated by Adam Davis, the executive director of Oregon Humanities, and, you know, very compelling conversations that would then lead to further engagement on the part of the people who participated. And so, as you can imagine, COVID, you know, eliminated the possibility of us being able to do that. Those in-person events were not only educational, they were also really inspiring. And one thing that I learned, and one of the reasons that in 2018 we started adding a lot of nonprofits and even larger companies who, quite frankly, have their own lobbyists, they don't need us to do that work for them, but they were all so impressed and inspired by this really diverse group of young professionals who were coming together to learn about these issues. And so I think there was a, you know, not only were our events educational, they actually helped people to feel like they were part of something. One thing that I've learned the hard way about entrepreneurs is that they're a pretty independent lot, and they're not necessarily joiners. And somehow we managed to create events that inspired people to attend and stick around and really get to know one another. And in the absence of that, you know, you can imagine we've had a gazillion and one Zoom events, ranging from, you know, a private forum with a city commissioner to a learning opportunity about a particular ballot measure. But needless to say, attendance has waned over the last 18 months. Everyone's very zoomed out, and people are really craving like getting back into person and being inspired by one another. So this fall, we are experimenting with doing a lot more programs in quantity and really diversifying the topics and the speakers, so that we can at least hopefully create programming that fits for everyone over the course of the fall. And then what has changed for us, I think, as not only as an organization, but as a city and as a region, as a state, as a country, is that COVID laid bare those inequities that we already knew were there. They were just like right underneath the surface, and made it pretty undeniable that we are living in a city with increasing income inequality, and that a lot of the challenges that our community is facing, whether it's increasing street homelessness or increased episodes of mental health crises on the streets or increasing gun violence, much of that is an outgrowth of an economic system that has really left a lot of people hanging, to say the least. And that is now undeniable. It's no longer just theory. And so we have really had to pivot the vast majority of our work on the advocacy side to addressing those drivers of income inequality. Because if we don't fix that, if we don't have an equitable economic recovery in this region, we're going to have even worse homelessness, even worse lack of access to clean transportation. So all the things that brought a lot of Business for a Better Portland members together in the first place, those challenges just simply cannot be solved if we don't solve this broader economic challenge.
Where I stand in terms of progressive values, but if, you know, if I were to play the devil's advocate and say, why should business be involved with social justice or community progress? What would you say to me or to a corporation who says, you know, that's not us, that's a social service agency?
Right. Well, I will say that prior to COVID, we were already experiencing as a region that many of our businesses were themselves being challenged by a lot of social conditions, whether that's, you know, your employee's kid doesn't have a safe route to school and they get hit by a car on their way to school, or Maybe your employees at a diner received a no-cause eviction. Those issues that are typically thought of as social issues, tenant protections or safe transportation, very quickly become business issues when your employees are on the receiving end of that. Another example pre-COVID is we had many of our members go to Salem in 2017 and again in 2019 to testify in support of increased funding for education, even if that meant an additional tax. And I had members who run, you know, at that time were running very successful tech companies. Their software engineers right out of college were being paid six-figure salaries, and yet they were losing staff. They were losing talent to other states because as those software engineers got married, chose to have a family, they're looking around and saying, this is not where I want to have children. I want to go to a state that really invests in its education system. And so I think even before COVID, businesses were already seeing that there's this really false dichotomy between what is a business issue and what is a social issue. You go to 2020 and 2021, and we see that, you know, because of increasing street homelessness, employees don't want to go back downtown because they don't feel safe. That is very much a business issue if your employees don't feel safe. And it's not sufficient to just simply remove people from one location and move them to the next, because then they're going to be a challenge for the next business down the street. And so we have known all along that we're all interconnected, right? And we can't necessarily separate you know, what your experience is as a business owner from what your experience is as a human. And same can be said for your employees. And COVID has really made that quite stark.
Yeah, and I know that you have experience, I guess, in the financial industry. You know, we have, there's big corporate businesses that exist that we sort of have to ask ourselves, do they care, or are they giving money, you know, like greening or pinking or giving money for social good? So I used to be of the nature of, you know, don't take that money. And now I'm of the nature of, if there's no influence, we might as well take that money and do something for social justice. So again, the question for you is, have you kind of seen a sea change? Have you seen companies or corporations that maybe were looked down upon or didn't have the best corporate practices now saying, okay, well, I really want to get involved. I think we need to be more of a social enterprise.
You know, it would actually be really hard for me to answer that question, Michael. I mean, I certainly in the wake of George Floyd's murder, we saw, you know, thousands of companies signing on and pledging. And we've seen recent reports about how anemic the fulfillment rate has been on those pledges. I guess I would just push back and question the fundamental question, which is, you know, yes, we are working on social justice issues, but we're not doing that just as a social justice issue. Our very existence is a demonstration of the fact that you can't separate those two. You can't, it's not possible to separate the well-being of the community from the well-being of the business, right? And so it's actually in a business's best interest to be involved in the community more directly to ensure that their employees are working in a safe neighborhood. Now, of course, we all know that there are companies that have employees that would very much like for their companies to be more involved in the community, but ultimately the day-to-day operations of their company are dictated by, you know, the next quarterly statement, right? And so if your investors are not in your community, that can create, you know, an incentive that makes it very difficult for even the most conscientious CEO to be civically engaged if he or she is being judged just on that one quarterly report. But I think for businesses that are not in that category, I think that folks definitely see the interconnection between the well-being of the community and the well-being of their business. And what small business owners in particular don't realize is just how much political and social capital they actually have and how much their voice actually matters to elected officials. I can have meeting after meeting after meeting with a city council person or a state legislator, but give me, you know, a few members of ours to talk very specifically about their own experience. It can really, really change the dynamic with an elected official and really, quite frankly, just help them to understand what it's like, what the reality is like for those business owners.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the examples of that? Small business owners who have gotten together and have advocated for legislative measures, or, you know, testified and added to policy arguments with real stories.
Sure. I'll try to think of something like pre-COVID, just to give you one example and then another. So back in 2017, when we just got started, we were working in collaboration with our member New Seasons, and they were helping to support a legislative priority of the Oregon Housing Alliance that would eliminate the use of no-cause evictions. And it was really helpful, in fact, transformative, I would say, when the Oregon Housing Alliance lobbyists could bring a representative from New Seasons Market and a representative from Organically Grown Corporation to talk about the experiences that some of their employees had had receiving no-cause evictions, not because of like anything malicious that tenant had done, but simply because perhaps an outside investor had purchased the property and wanted to flip it. And so those personal stories helped to humanize that this is in fact a real human issue and a business issue both, right? Because if your employee can't work at that particular store any longer because they've had to move 30 miles out after that no cause eviction, it's a disruption to your business, to your store. So that's one example in the early days. Later on in 2019, we had proposed legislation for that would have created a loan loss reserve. It was around the effort to increase access to capital for women and minority and rural entrepreneurs. And we did something called an information hearing that happens typically in the months preceding an official legislative session. It's when legislators come, they go to their committee assignments, they hear informational testimony about something that might be coming up in the next legislative session or maybe the session after. And we brought a few entrepreneurs, a woman who had tried to get a loan to start her business, a Black entrepreneur who had previously been a banker, and a woman who runs an economic development district out in rural Oregon. And they all told the stories of either their own personal story or the stories of clients and stakeholders that they had worked with who, even though they had this very viable business model, because they didn't have access to collateral, and the reason they didn't have access to collateral is because they didn't have access to intergenerational wealth that would have created that collateral, they weren't able to access the loan. And we thought we were laying the groundwork for legislation like 2 years down the road. And lo and behold, the testimony was so compelling. They said, you know, we've decided we want to make this a priority bill for the February 2020 session. So that's an example of how like legislators can listen and be truly influenced by the voices of business owners. And then in COVID, you know, one of the silver linings of COVID is that we can convene a group of business owners on Zoom who are from that particular legislator's district and present a variety of perspectives, that of a restaurant owner, that of a brick and mortar retail, maybe someone whose business is doing quite well in COVID, and present to that legislator like really diverse realities of what the results of COVID have been. And I feel pretty confident that those engagements that we had on Zoom with legislators that featured the voices of those business owners is really what resulted in millions and millions of dollars of relief being allocated by our state's emergency board in 2020. And so that's the most recent example that I can offer. And so I think it's not easy, you know. And especially when you're calling upon, you know, small business owners who are already so slammed, like the last thing they have time for is another meeting, and yet their voice, instead of my voice or instead of a paid lobbyist's voice, is just like just so impactful.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I know like Portland is, I don't know if I want to say it's having an identity crisis. I'm one of the guilty people that moved from California here. But, you know, Portland's changing, and I think a lot of people are asking these questions of where does Portland go? Is it a small business hub? Is it going to become too corporate? I guess my question for you is, like, what do you see as the future of Portland and the business world? Is it one of small businesses continuing and becoming strong social enterprises? Is it one where it's going to become a little bit more corporate? Hopefully those corporations are also responsible. Do you have any sort of idea or prediction on where we're going, I guess would be the question.
Well, Michael, I feel like Portland and the Portland region is really at a significant fork in the road right now. And I can't necessarily tell you or give you a prediction. What I can tell you is that in the Great Recession in 2009, the economic recovery efforts that our region pursued led to some really great prosperity. I'm sure you remember prior to COVID, your office is in the Central East Side, bustling, lots of restaurants and bars and expensive cocktails and fun shows to go to and such. But the reality is that that economic vitality actually never returned to the vast majority of the metro region. In fact, our state economist came out with a report back in like 2018, I believe it was, that said the recovery from the Great Recession actually never happened east of 82nd Avenue. And so when people were like, well, why are there so many people sleeping outside? Well, one of the reasons is we haven't, you know, kept up with the demand for housing, and our federal government has been divesting in housing as infrastructure for almost 50 years now. But the other reason is that incomes were not keeping up with rents. And so there was a very refreshing conversation early in COVID where folks would say, you know, we are not going to go back to normal. Normal never was. We, you know, normal was not actually helping the vast majority of people, and there wasn't economic vitality in most of our region. But in order for us to genuinely experience an inclusive economic recovery that doesn't widen the income inequality that we went into COVID already having, we as a region, our city, our county, our metro government, and our state all have to make some very, very deliberate choices about what policies they're going to prioritize and what funding they're going, you know, how are they going to prioritize all of the federal funds that are coming from Congress. And I can say that for Business for a Better Portland, for a number of our partners, the Oregon Native American Chamber, the Philippine American Chamber, we're working closely with Micro Enterprise Services of Oregon, MISO. There's a really important economic development body that nobody knows about called the Greater Portland Economic Development District. And that team is doing incredible work convening all of the parties that can bring us all together to implement an economic recovery plan that has a variety of actions in that plan that, if implemented and properly funded, could potentially lead us out of that income inequality that we came into COVID with. But if we take a hands-off approach or a business as usual approach, it's likely that we will only reinforce those income inequalities. And what we'll have is actually, unfortunately, greater need on the streets. I say to Multnomah County leaders, I know you guys don't do economic development, but if we as a region don't have an inclusive economic recovery, you're going to have more clients knocking at your door at Multnomah County seeking social services. And none of us want that to happen. So I think the jury is still out. I think there are a lot of really great opportunities, but I don't see a lot of leadership at the elected leader level who's really focusing on this. And so I'm hopeful that, in this coming campaign season, especially with some really strong candidates for Multnomah County Chair, for example, that we will hear from folks about why this actually matters, because it's admittedly sort of wonky, but at the end of the day, it's going to make the difference between us having a healthier region or having, a lot of despair outside. And we already know what that looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seemed like one of the issues, and I'm definitely not an expert on this, but there were, regional economic development zones, and people got, a tax break for developing there. But what happened is, instead of affordable housing or the commercial spaces that were below, they're not affordable. So you look at MLK, for example, and you have, $2,000 a month condos, and then you have commercial spaces underneath that are not affordable. So what happens is, yes, that real estate developer got a tax break, and yes, there was development, but then that doesn't really give the opportunities that were needed. So we're sort of stuck with property that doesn't necessarily match the people and the needs.
Yeah, I think you're referring to the opportunity zones.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, the opportunity zones, that policy, that incentive is actually what's helped to pay for the Ritz-Carlton downtown. I mean, I think the last thing Portland needs right now probably is a Ritz-Carlton. but there you have it. I mean, that's a case in point of a particular type of economic policy. This was obviously pre-COVID when that was developed, but it was intended to create a particular outcome. And there was a lot of privatization of the benefits. And it would be a worthwhile endeavor to take a look at, what could that foregone tax revenue, what could that have done to address homelessness in downtown Portland alone, or what kinds of economic benefits did it deliver for the community more broadly, or was it just for those particular investors? And I confess that I haven't studied that particular issue very well, so I can't speak intelligently to it. But I think just at the surface, it does really make you wonder what is it that we're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, and that's a great example, because as I go down there, everybody misses the food cart pods that were there. And so there is this question of, yes, potentially you have larger conferences, or you have more money from the Ritz-Carlton, but what about all the people who came to Portland wanting to go to that food cart area? Mm-hmm. And then they would go, visit all the other restaurants and all the mm-hmm. other shops. So
right.
I think that's kind of where Portland's at as well, is mm-hmm. asking what is valued, and what is a short-term form of money versus a long-term, this is what the city should be or should stand for. So, I haven't studied it at length either, but I would be curious to know how those things happen or how they can stop or how there could be more equitable conversations around things like that that happen.
Yeah, it's really hard to stay on top of all of those developments, that's for sure.
It is a good example, though, that it's a Ritz-Carlton.
Yeah. Yeah, if you, I don't know if you read The Oregon Way, but Adam Davis, who's the executive director of Oregon Humanities, has written some reflective essays about that building because the Oregon Humanities office is across the street from it. So if you're, I haven't read those in a while. I need to go back and refresh my memory, but I'm sure they'd be very compelling and thought provoking.
Yeah, absolutely. So if people want to generally get involved, they want to be business for good, or they want to, you know, they have a reflective moment of their company and say, okay, we want to do better. What would you say to them? Like, how would they go about that?
That's a really good question. You know, I think it really depends on what they want to accomplish. And you know, there is, of course, the B Corp certification process that a company can go through. And that's a very rigorous process that evaluates a number of aspects of your business operations. And a number of companies, you know, small to very, very large, have benefited greatly from going through that certification process and being required to measure their impact around everything from, you know, emissions to labor practices, you know, the types of benefits that they provide to their employees. And that's it's a very intense and long-term commitment. There are local programs, like through our Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, there's the Sustainability at Work program, little, you know, incentive program to help you with your recycling and your waste management. So if you're looking, if a company is looking to make impact around that, you know, I think there are countless programs out there, how to limit your greenhouse gas emissions footprint, for example. But one thing that is an emerging conversation, especially in the wake of, you know, just the climate disaster that we've been experiencing over the last summer, is the degree to which no amount of we can't carbon footprint our way out of what we're in right now, and that what is really needed is massive policy change. I think that industry and others have done an excellent job at turning this problem, which is a global and industrial problem, back on us as individuals, and then we translate that to our individual companies. And that's not to say that we shouldn't all, you know, make our own individual or company level efforts, but the rate at which we need to improve and reduce our emissions at a global scale is only possible if we make those changes at a policy level. And I would say the same thing can be said for transportation. I mean, I've always really admired, you know, the bike to work challenges and things that motivate people to participate. And those are all really great programs. But at the end of the day, if we don't have policy changes that result in making it more affordable to commute in a cost in a clean way, then we won't see those changes. And similarly, on some of the other issues that we work on around economic opportunity, it really all comes down to policy. And so, that's where the biggest lever is. And that's why Business for a Better Portland focuses at that level.
And would there be policy that would enforce change at a company level? So for example, you know, we all try not to use plastic straws, right? But what if a company like Cisco, who is providing plastic straws to restaurants all over, had to provide affordable, decomposable plastic straws? something like that. So I guess the question is part of the answer legislating big business to some degree so that they're on a larger scale, making these environmental changes?
Yeah, it's less about whether they're a big business or a small business. It's about how do we reassess how we do business, whether we're a large business or a small business. Obviously, a larger business is going to have a larger carbon footprint, for example. But if the current system allows that company to externalize the cost on the environment or the costs of that plastic going into the waste stream, then they'll forever, continue to do that. It's only when there are requirements to do otherwise, or there is a cost that is associated with that, with generating that waste, that the equation shifts.
Yeah, and well, those are the companies that could probably do it much easier. They have the
scale
already,
right?
So that it's kind of like not just with requiring of individuals to do things, but requiring of small businesses. You know, a small business that's barely getting by, they're going to say to you, "Well, we can't afford disposable plastic to-go items."
Yeah.
Whereas, if all of the businesses who are getting those manufactured items from a larger company, just as an option, got those disposable materials. So, I mean, that goes back to a lot of things, the money in politics and oil. And
yeah.
But do you think that from a small scale, for example, if Oregon were to say, you know, we're not going to allow styrofoam anymore in the state, could something like that happen? Or is that just, there's too many actors, too many big business and politics?
Yeah, I actually feel a little ignorant right now about environmental and solid waste issues. I have been so hyper-focused over the last 4 years on issues around housing and homelessness and economic development that I feel like that part of my brain has atrophied. So I'm afraid to say anything that would belie my ignorance. I think generally speaking, you're always going to have particular interests, regardless of the policy, who are currently profiting from the status quo. And if a legislator, whether that's a city leader that wants to eliminate plastic straws in the city of Portland, or it's a state leader that wants to eliminate styrofoam, there's going to be a well-funded effort to prevent that from occurring. And then there will be a well-funded education or misinformation campaign, depending on how you look at it. And I think that applies to almost every issue that we all work on, regardless of whether or not it's an environmental or solid waste issue. So I think that that's why, you know, the role that Business for a Better Portland has stepped into play is so important, Michael, because typically the business community, in air quotes, is perceived as basically, you know, a handful of organizations. And it's that handful of organizations that has historically had sufficient funding from their larger dues paying members to have a regular presence at City Hall, to have a regular presence in Salem. And so for an organization like ours to aggregate the voices of, you know, first it was 100 and then it was 200 and now it's 450. Those small organizations and companies would never in a million years be able to figure out how in the heck to advocate for a more equitable recovery, but they share our values, right? And they want that to happen because they know that it will be better for their community and ultimately for their business. But they're not going to have time to do that on their own. And so it's, we're really trying to flip on its head what it means to be a chamber of commerce. And, or I would say we have, we're not trying to, we have. And, so the vast majority of our members, pay $200 a year to be members. And if you're a larger company and can afford to pay $5,000 a year, that's great, but you're not going to be able to dictate our policy priorities. So there's not a pay-to-play dynamic that exists in a lot of traditional or conventional business associations and trade associations. And so back to your original question, like if there is no one that can speak on behalf of a different business perspective, when that well-funded misinformation campaign gets going, then it's very difficult for legislators to sort out, and they're understaffed and underpaid, and they don't have all the time in the world to study every single issue. And so it's really incumbent on organizations like ours to continue to grow our membership so that we can deepen the capacity of our staff to represent those more community-centered values when it comes to advocating on whatever issue is before.
And small business owners, you know, they're so busy too. They don't always know what's going on.
Yeah.
Who's making decisions for them.
You know?
So I think that's great. Right. So I have 5 questions for you.
Okay.
Ask everybody.
Okay.
So the first one is, what's a quote or a mantra that you live by?
To whom much is given, much is expected. I learned that in high school. I went to an all-girls Catholic high school. That's really where I learned about social justice, actually, was from these nuns in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm still in touch with my social justice teacher from my 10th grade. And, you know, I'll be honest, I think the nuns, when they were saying, like, to whom much is given, much is expected, you know, it was more like, be a good girl. But that has sunk in for me a lot more over the last, you know, couple of decades of my life, and especially in COVID, just the degree of, you know, privilege that I'm afforded in so many ways. And so that's one of the things that fuels my work for Business for Better Portland.
The next one is, what is your favorite childhood memory?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. Well, probably crabbing. So when I was little, we would go to a place in South Carolina, an island off the coast of South Carolina in what's called the Low Country. And we, in the afternoon, sometimes after going to the beach, we would go to the grocery store and buy chicken necks or turkey necks and, you know, like meat packages, and then put them on these very crude lines. Like it was just a line of twine with this massive, it was like a massive safety pin or something. You just like stick the safety pin through the neck, and then you wind it up and you throw it out into the ocean or to the bay where we were, the little sound where we were. And then you slowly reel it in, and you know, every once in a while you would catch a blue crab. And I didn't really like eating them so much, but I loved reeling them in and throwing them back out.
what's a failure or mistake you've made that actually turned out for the best?
Turned out for the best. Gosh, I've made so many mistakes. Which ones do I want to talk about publicly? Well, so you remember earlier I was telling you about that that opportunity that our organization unexpectedly had to have a bill focused on access to capital, right? Mm-hmm. And so this was in the fall of 2019. We had only been around for 2.5 years. We were approaching our third birthday. We were basically 2 FTE and a contractor and a working board. And I think that had I had less emotion and less excitement about it, I would have recognized that as great of an opportunity as it was to pursue that legislative opportunity, it was honestly just like we were a little out of our skis, and we were. And we had never run a bill before. We didn't have a statewide coalition. It stretched everything that I had and a lot of people who were working with us on it. I know that we, you know, on a number of occasions, stuck our foot in our mouths, like whatever metaphor you want to use, like we did it. And it was thoroughly exhausting, and the bill didn't pass at the end of the day. And you know, the strange thing that happened was 7 days after COVID hit and we went into lockdown. I mean, I'm sorry, 7 days after the bill was killed, we went into lockdown, and there was no small business voice that was organized at the state level to speak on behalf of the small business community. And so in March and April of 2020, BBPDX went back to that ad hoc coalition that we had convened on the fly, admittedly, in 2019 and 2020. And we began advancing sign-on letters to the emergency board to say, you know, you can't wait to spend relief dollars. You need to spend it now. If you wait till the fall, a lot of those businesses are going to be closed by then. And that initial effort in March and April turned into a pop-up coalition called Oregon Small Business United that we run in collaboration with our partner, Oregon Native American Chamber. And it now has over 35 organizations that have signed on to that coalition. We worked together as a team for the rest of 2020 to secure not only millions and millions more in relief, direct relief that went to small businesses all over the state. But we also secured $3 million in grants that went to community-based organizations around the state to provide technical assistance and navigation services to small businesses that were really struggling in that moment. And then that really prepared us for an active legislative session in 2021. And lo and behold, that loan loss reserve that didn't make it out of the legislature in 2020 ended up making it out in 2021. And so I think, you know, you just, thankfully that mistake, it was redeemed, you know, by those, how those things unfolded. But it was definitely, you know, very challenging along the way.
Sounds like it worked out. what issue or issues keep you up at night?
Well, the ones we've already been discussing, I think that there are, I have a lot of friends and colleagues who have a lot of climate grief, and I respect that and send them a lot of resources about that. And I guess I've just sort of partitioned that part of my brain off for the time being, because I have such despair around growing income inequality and what the consequences of that will be for our city and our region and our state and our nation. And I really see, like I was saying earlier, that we are at a fork in the road right now. And whether or not we pursue a more equitable economic recovery is going to make the difference between, you know, do we create greater shared prosperity, or do we continue to create a community in which certain people live safely behind gates and others are, you know, more and more people are living outside. And I realize that sounds hyperbolic, but I don't think that it actually is, because that has been the fate of nations around the world when they start to experience mass income inequality. I think that probably is definitely the thing that keeps me up.
And then here's a fun one is, who is your favorite pop star or favorite band?
My favorite pop star or band? Well, I will say that I can tell you the most about a band called Lake Street Dive. Found out about them at Pickathon several summers ago. Hot summer, listened to them in an indoor venue. It was so brutal, but they were really amazing. And they've gone on to I don't think you would say fame and fortune, but they've definitely hit the bigger time. And I got to see them at Edgefield not too long ago, last month. So that music brings me a lot of joy for sure.
Lake Street Dive, is that
Lake Street Dive, yeah.
Well, that's about it. I mean, the last part is if you want to give a shout out to someone in the community that you think is doing well, and then also how do people get a hold of you? So if someone wants to have more information, to collaborate, to become a member, any of those things, how would someone do so?
Yeah. A shout out to someone who's doing well, like that I admire their work, you mean?
Yeah. Or someone who, for example, you know, we've had people mention a nonprofit that they support, and people, like a friend that they're working with,
mm-hmm.
something that you're sort of your fingers on the pulse, but you don't know if others know about what they're doing.
Ah, got it. Well, yeah, I have to say, and I know she's a rising star, so maybe others already know about her, but Candace Avalos is a real inspiration to me. She recently became the executive director of Verde, and they're doing some incredible work in Cully to lift up the needs of the neighbors there. And I would highly recommend that folks learn about her work at Verde and also her leadership on various committees in the city. She's very inspiring. She turned 33 yesterday. I saw that on social media. She just boggles my mind. I can't believe how well-spoken and knowledgeable she is about such a range of issues at such a young age. And so she gives me hope for the city of Portland. And if people want to get in touch, it's pretty easy to find us. We are bbpdx.org. That's boybpdx.org. And we'd certainly welcome you to join if you're a small business owner. If you have a larger company and you want to sponsor some of our programming, we in COVID times have very affordable sponsorships for our online Zoom programming. And then we also have a 501c3, a sister organization. It's got a very creative name. It's called Friends of BBPDX. And that's literally just friendsofbbpdx.org. And so if you wanted to make a charitable contribution as an individual, we would definitely welcome that as well. And happy to hear from anybody. And I host an online coffee on Fridays for maximum of 3 people at a time, just as a way of getting to know people. And we may start doing those in person sometime soon.
Thank you for doing this podcast. Thank you for all of the work that you do. I am inspired by you. You give me hope. So
thank you. Please, it's so nice of you.
Please continue doing what you're doing.
Really appreciate it, Michael. Thanks for hosting this.
Yeah, absolutely. Good to see you. Have a good day.
You too. Take care. Bye.
We want to thank Ashley Henry for being on this episode of the show. Remember to visit the Facebook page for Business for a Better Portland. And while you're there, click on the link tree for more information and resources. Be sure not to miss any of our upcoming guests by subscribing to the podcast on your favorite streaming service. You can also visit alloftyourbusinesspodcast.com for previous episodes, custom gear, and if you happen to know anybody that you think would be a great fit for the podcast, click our contact page and let us know.